Chapter 5 Maps and Plans. Human dignity is something one need not look for in the world of capitalists. V.I. Lenin. The pathos was lost on Sir George Buchanan. It did not help that he had missed the drama's crucial opening act. The ambassador had arranged for a short holiday in Finland and left the country just before the start of the first strikes. He returned to find the whole of Petrograd in chaos. Fires were raging in the law courts and police headquarters. The streets were full of loud young men and rifle shots. While open cars careened along the embankment under his windows, many packed with drunken youngsters waving flags. When his daughter Meriel's train arrived at the Finland station, General Knox himself drove over to collect her, for there was no functioning public transport left in the capital. The inconvenience was staggering, the dangers all too clear. Sir George's wife had been alarmed enough to send the members of her sewing circle home that afternoon while it was light. On the 1st of March, the 14th of March, by the calendar that London used, Sir George thought it advisable to reassure the public back in England. In one of many telegrams that day, he requested the printing of a notice to the effect that all 2,000 British residents in Petrograd were well. He did not know that London adopted to treat Russian news with a delicacy more usually reserved for unexploded bombs. The War Cabinet, having decided that events in Petrograd are not to be mentioned in the press, reads the neat scribble on the file. Such an announcement will, if published, require careful dressing. The Allies saw the uprising as a betrayal. Their problem was not so much that red flags might encourage troublemakers nearer home, for it was high time that the Russians had a sensible democracy. What was really worrying them was the idea that all those grey-faced workmen in their sheepskin coats, so far away and yet so crucial suddenly to European plans, might really mean it, when they kept demanding peace. They could not let the revolution take just any course it chose. But the British were prudent enough to start with a little Anglo-Saxon charm. On the 3rd or 16th of March, when it was clear that Tsarism had collapsed, Buchanan received a copy of the greeting that the leaders of the patriotic British labour movement had prepared, with Foreign Office help, for Messrs. Kerensky and Chiedze. Organised labour in Great Britain is watching with deepest sympathy the efforts of the Russian people to deliver themselves from reactionary elements which are impeding their advance to victory, it began. Labour in England and France has long realised that despotism of Germany must be overthrown if way is to be opened for free and peaceful development of European nations. This conviction has inspired them to make unprecedented efforts and sacrifices, and we confidently look forward to assistance of Russian labour in achieving the objective to which we have devoted ourselves. Earnestly trust you will impress on your followers that any remission of effort means disaster. The message could not have been clearer. Whatever rhetoric they cared to use, the Russians were expected to keep fighting on until the other members of their team agreed to stop. In private, too, the Foreign Office mandarins had doubts about a people's government of any kind. The Soviet, advised Buchanan, is for peace at any price, and its advent to power will mean disaster for the military point of view. His instructions from London, received on the 4th or 17th of March, were unequivocal. In deciding whether the British were to recognise the new regime, he should be guided solely by the attitude of the new government towards the war. All your influence should be thrown into the scale against any administration which is not resolved to fight to a finish. The real difficulty here, Frank Linley, the British Embassy councillor, wrote from Petrograd on the 7th or the 20th of March, is that we have two governments. The real one, under Prince Lvov, and a committee of workmen's and soldiers' delegates without whose orders none of the men will do anything. The British colony are naturally rather nervous, as all Russians agree that a terrible class hatred exists under the surface, and that if it once broke loose, the consequences would be awful. The best that could be said was that the real government looked businesslike, composed entirely of the sort of men who knew what honourable service meant. On the 9th or 22nd of March, and with a wishful thinking that took little cognizance of facts, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Andrew Bonar, saluted Russia's new administration on behalf of Parliament. "This House sends the Duma its fraternal greetings," he declaimed, though what he should have greeted was the provisional government, "and tenders to the Russian people its heartiest congratulations upon the establishment among them of free institutions." He must have imagined a chamber full of gentlemen exactly like himself. The academic and Slavonic expert, Bernard Pears, was certainly a fan. "These were my friends," he later wrote. "Of the 12 new ministers, 7 were actually collaborators of my Russian review in Liverpool." Better still, Milyakov had met George V, and though a Marxist in his youth, he had recently declared in London that he belonged to His Majesty's opposition, not the opposition to His Majesty. To London's evident relief, this Milyakov appeared to be the driving force behind the brand new government, although officially he was no more than foreign minister. The nominated premier, Prince Georgi Lvov, took a few days to get to Petrograd from his home in Moscow. "At last, we felt ourselves au complet," wrote Milyakov, upon Lvov's arrival in the Tauride. Unfortunately, it turned out that Lvov's talent did not run to decisive national leadership. "The prince was evasive and cautious," Milyakov reported. "He reacted to events in a gentle, defensive manner, and talked his way out with gentle phrases." "He sat in the driver's box," Vladimir Nabokov, the father of the famous novelist, conceded. "But he didn't even try to pick up the reins." Watching from Britain, Samuel Hoare concluded that Lvov was a man better qualified to be chairman of the London County Council than to be the chief of an unstable government in the midst of a great revolution. In Petrograd, Buchanan was dubious about the new regime from the first. "If only the present government could get the situation well in hand," he reported on the 5th or 18th of March 1917. "The best solution would be that it should continue to act as a provisional government for as long as the war lasted." Privately, however, Sir George considered that the ministers were "not such as to inspire me with great confidence for the future. Most of them already showed signs of strain, and struck me as having undertaken a task beyond their strength." The French ambassador was more forthright, and judged the revolutionary state with the discernment of a connoisseur. His verdict was that Russia really needed a Danton, if not a Robespierre. Instead, it seems to have been saddled with a committee that would have had trouble managing a private dining club. "We shall now be faced with economic, social, religious, and ethical problems," Palaiolog wrote to his French Prime Minister, Alexandre Ribot. "These problems are very formidable from the point of view of the war. For the Slav imagination, far from being constructive, like that of the Latin or Anglo-Saxon, is essentially anarchical and dispersive." His prediction was very dark. "In the present phase of the revolution, Russia cannot make peace or war." The one bright spot, as all outsiders soon agreed, was Alexander Speedy Kerensky. "He is obviously the most original figure in the provisional government," observed Palaiolog, "and seems bound to become its mainspring." Buchanan thought him "the only man to whom we could look to keep Russia in the war." The Justice Minister was everywhere, tripping between appointments with the British ambassador and the Petrograd military governor, the Tauride, and his own Masonic lodge. Though he retained his foothold in the Soviet, his sympathies were all with bourgeois government. In mid-March, he reassured Alfred Knox that the present position with two governments was impossible, and that the Soviet was losing ground. The Ulsterman duly recorded that there is only one man who can save the country, and that is Kerensky, for he still has the confidence of the over-articulate Petrograd mob. The provisional government could not exist in Petrograd if it were not for Kerensky. Kerensky himself later looked back upon those first exciting weeks as among the happiest of my political career. However happy a newly promoted minister might be, however, the Soviet continued to exist. As the ambassadors of Britain, France, and Italy gave formal recognition to the provisional government on the 11th or 24th of March, the US ambassador, the flamboyant David R. Francis, having done so 2 days earlier, the Soviet's presence loomed beyond the lighted windows like a monster from the Baltic swamp. The new war minister, Alexander Guchkov, might have appeared composed enough in monocle and handmade suit, but only a few days before, he had expressed his nervous doubts to the army's chief of staff. "The provisional government does not possess any real power," he had complained, "and its directives are carried out only to the extent that it is permitted by the Soviet of workers' and soldiers' deputies, which enjoys all the essential elements of real power, since the troops, the railroads, the post and telegraph are all in its hands. One can say flatly that the provisional government exists only so long as it is permitted by the Soviet." That idea alone was enough to sour the ministerial champagne. As Guchkov would confide to General Knox, however, even larger problems had begun to intrude. "I saw Minister of War for a few minutes today," the attaché informed London just 2 weeks later. "He is worried over fall in production in dockyards. Factories in Petrograd only produced 30 to 60% of what they did before revolution. Even Council of Workmen and Soldier Deputies was powerless to contend with the extreme element which consists of Jews and imbeciles. He agreed that it would come sooner or later to a trial of strength with extremists, but he said government had not yet physical power on which it could depend, and he asked me to keep this very secret. Council have the keys to all government ciphers and control of wireless stations." The last thing Guchkov and his friends required was a flood of even worse extremists from abroad. It was the Soviet, armed with all that telegraph and wireless, that appeared determined to summon every last troublemaker back to Petrograd from provincial Russia and beyond. The first internal exiles began arriving that very week, travelling from the villages where they'd languished under Tsarist rule. With them came a reminder of a smouldering, all-encompassing problem beyond the capital, that of the peasants and their age-long hunger for the land. The land question was the ultimate challenge to any government that believed in property rights, for it could not be addressed without stripping landlords of their estates. Worse, it cast a shadow over Petrograd, for the army was the key to any revolutionary settlement, and the army, like the population as a whole, was primarily composed of peasants. Compared with worries on that scale, the Allies and their day-to-day demands may have appeared as pettily troubling to the new government as a swarm of gnats. But they could not be ignored. It turned out that the old regime had bound itself to France and Britain with multiple hidden treaties and wheedling promises. The most important secret deals dated to 1915, when Milyukov's predecessors at the Foreign Ministry had signed away their country's remaining interests along the Adriatic coast. A volatile member of the provisional government leapt from his chair when he heard this, declaring that "we can never, never accept those treaties." The equally secret quid pro quo, however, at least in the case of victory, was that Russia was to have Constantinople and the Dardanelles. With his long-standing interest in the Balkans, that bait meant everything to Milyukov. He may even have been imagining a Russian city on the Golden Horn as he prepared an official declaration on foreign policy published on the 7th or 20th of March, 1917. "The government," he announced, "will sacredly observe the alliances which bind us to other powers and will unswervingly carry out the agreement entered into with the Allies. When that statement was first issued, few knew exactly what those sacred undertakings were. When they were told, sitting around a table in their new office at the Marinsky Palace, even Milyakov's close colleagues were sceptical. "I dragged out the treaties from the ministry's archives," the foreign minister remembered, "and illustrated my report with detailed maps." To his dismay, Lvov himself described the annexation of the Straits as plunder and demanded that Russia repudiate the swindling provision. The uproar in the ex-com was worse still. The Soviet had grown, and by mid-March it numbered about 3,000 deputies, most of them from soldiers' groups. Even the Tauride could not cope. Kerensky thought the palace seemed to groan and sway under the pressure of the mighty human waves, and eventually the entire show would move first to the Michael Theatre and then to the Naval Academy on Vasilevsky Island. Wherever it convened, however, the Soviet appeared to be engaged in one extended session, stormy and verbose, with intervals for sleep that never seemed to come in time. For anyone who lived through it, the memory of that first month would float like some chaotic seasick dream on cheap tobacco fumes and unrequited longing for a good night's rest. The main fault line in the Soviet no longer ran between the far left and the rest. New tensions and a new agenda had been created by the mass influx of soldiers' deputies, many from units close to the front. Though Petrograd still yearned for peace, these serving soldiers did not want their comrades' sacrifices at the front, the strain and suffering, the deaths, to be sold short. While the Soviet was still in the Tauride, indeed, a woman agitator, whom Sakharov judged to be a Bolshevik, had been practically torn to pieces for saying, "Down with the war!" The army was a force of over 7 million men, drawn from the length and breadth of the empire. Its mood remained unfathomable. The ex-com, which remained in the Tauride, eventually necessitating the use of a fleet of cars to shuttle back and forth to the Soviet, was alarmed by the threat of a fatal breach within the revolutionary movement. Aside from a brief session on the 3rd or 16th of March, its members had avoided much discussion of the war. Their goals had been more local and immediate in the first days. The workers, as Sukarnov put it, really meaning his own group, instinctively felt that the whole question might turn out to be extremely complicated and teeming with submerged rocks. But by the second week of March, it was becoming clear that someone would have to speak for the Soviet. Milyukov and the right-wing press could not be left with a free hand. As if to concentrate everyone's minds, on the 12th or 25th of March, the Volinsky Regiment, which just 2 weeks before had been among the first to join the revolution, appeared in the Tauride in full formation, with all its officers, urging Soviet deputies to remember their brothers in the trenches and support a war to final victory. The ex-com wrestled over forms of words. For its socialist members, the goals of revolution had always included peace in Europe. At the very least, the majority knew the formula agreed at Zimmerwald, which the Swiss leader Robert Grimm reiterated in mid-March. "The most important and absolute right of the Russian Revolution in the present moment," he declared, "is the struggle for peace without annexations or indemnities on the basis of national self-determination." No annexations meant no Dardanelles. It meant no Russian adventure in the divided territories of Ukraine. It meant resisting French demands for their lost provinces of Alsace and Lorraine. If it were going to take such an explosive line, the ex-com had to square it with the soldiers first. The Soviet's answer, a manifesto that it described proudly as an appeal to the peoples of the world, was issued on the 14th or 27th of March. As well as clarifying the ideas of the revolutionaries themselves, its purpose was to shame the governments of Europe into opening peace talks. "The Russian democracy has shattered in the dust of the age-old despotism of the Tsar," it announced to all fraternal populations, and enters your family of nations as an equal and as a mighty force in the struggle for our common liberation. That much was enough to disgust the French ambassador, who noted in his diary that he awaited the reply of the Teutonic proletariat. But the manifesto did not venture any timetable for peace negotiations, nor did it call on Russian soldiers to disarm. The Soviet condemned the war and called for a decisive struggle against the grasping ambitions of the governments of all countries. But Russia's guns still pointed westwards, and its bayonets were fixed. "The time has come to start a decisive struggle," the Soviet volunteered. "The time has come for the people to take into their own hands the decision of the question of war or peace. Unless the Allies revised their war aims, however, the most immediate struggle would be inside Russia's government itself. Meanwhile, despite the people's weariness of war, the Soviet could promise only to resist the policy of conquest of its ruling classes. It did not have the power to make peace, and it could not betray the army or its own soldier deputies. Appeasing them, it offered an assurance that the Russian Revolution will not retreat before the bayonets of conquerors, and it will not allow itself to be crushed by foreign military force. The Soviet chairman, Nikolai Chidze, emphasized the same idea in an editorial in Izvestia on the 16th of March, informing readers that, "In addressing the Germans, we do not let the rifles out of our hands." "It's simply shit," Lenin spluttered, after reading a report of recent speeches in the Soviet. "I repeat, shit." Whenever he picked up a pen that March, he might as well have drawn the pin from a grenade. Before the news of revolution broke, his wife had likened him to the white wolf in London Zoo, the one creature among the tigers and the bears that never grew accustomed to its confinement. But now his frustration was intolerable. It had been a Polish revolutionary called Bronski who first brought him the news of insurrection in Petrograd, stopping by as Lenin and his wife were leaving for the library. The effect had been like an electric current. The leader paced and coloured, shouted, punched the air. "Staggering!" he exclaimed to Krupskaya. "Such a surprise! We must go home. It's so incredibly unexpected." But the only journey he could make in the short term was down the steep lane to the shore of Zurich's lake, where there were kiosks with a good range of the latest Swiss and foreign newspapers. The comrade he suddenly missed was his old friend Inessa Armand. "There is a telegram in the Zurich Post of 15th of March that in Russia the revolution was victorious after 3 days of struggle," he wrote to her that day. "If the Germans are not lying, then it has happened." At this point, Inessa was living in Bogny-sur-Clairon, another centre for the Russian exiles in Switzerland. So Lenin's intention, in part, was to keep her informed. The real issue, however, was that he needed her help. "I would very much like you to find out discreetly for me in England if I would be granted passage," coaxed Lenin on the 18th of March. He was certain that she would rush off to England right away. But she showed no inclination to comply. When that became clear, he hoped she might at least look into other options, which included attempting to get a Russian or Swiss national to hand over his passport without saying it is for me. The news from Petrograd had shaken the entire Russian colony in Switzerland. The Russian consul in Davos held a reception to greet the new age of liberty, somewhat half-heartedly, since he was not the revolutionary type. And many of the small foundations that supported refugees began to talk of imminent repatriation. There were 7,000 Russian nationals in Switzerland, and their welcome was wearing thin, but still, there was no easy way to get back home. The British saw no particular virtue in helping subversives to travel via the North Sea, while the provisional government was horrified, as Guchkov had observed, by anyone who might belong to the camp of extremists, Jews, and imbeciles. Caught between these unresponsive authorities, Lenin and his friends were tormented by the newspaper reports of Russians who were starting to return to Petrograd from their exile in Scandinavia, a safe and submarine-free journey through neutral cities with good rail links. The happy fortune of that lot must have made Switzerland seem more than ever like the white wolf's wretched cage. The newspapers followed the drama of the revolution day by day. Kerensky had remained the star of Russia's dazzling new show. Indeed, the dapper hero had only to appear in a theatre or take the public stage for the crowd to rise in a collective rapture. Lenin called him the little braggart. But Kerensky was taking credit for a string of important reforms. Russia became the freest country in the world as the new government granted an amnesty for political prisoners, abolished the death penalty, and dissolved what was left of the detested secret police. Inspired by the soldiers' response to the liberal promises of the Soviets' Order No. 1, it set up a committee to examine the case for army reform. Lenin refused to celebrate, deploring the fact that the bourgeoisie had managed to get its arse onto all the ministerial seats. Kerensky he dismissed in yet another snappy line, describing him as a balalaika on which they play to deceive the workers and peasants. His irritation prompted curt instructions to the Russians who were returning through Tornio. On the 6th or 19th of March, Lenin sent a telegram to a group of lucky Bolsheviks as they prepared to board their train. "No trust in and no support for the provisional government," it read. "Kerensky especially suspect. Arming the proletariat is the only guarantee. No rapprochement with other parties. Telegraph this to Petrograd." A few days later, he was beginning to consider how worker Soviets might actually take power. "We need a state," he wrote on the 11th or 24th of March, "but not the kind the bourgeoisie needs, with organs of government in the shape of a police force, an army, and a bureaucracy. The proletariat must smash this ready-made state machine and substitute a new one of the entire armed people." The trouble was that he remained the comrade who was watching, as he put it, from afar. "You can imagine what torture it is for all of us to be stuck here at a time like this," he complained in one of his many tetchy letters to Jakob Fürstenberg in Sweden. "We have to go by some means, even if it is through hell." Imagining himself to be on an English blacklist, "England won't let us," he raged to Anessa. He tried repeatedly to organise a false passport so as to sneak back into Russia unobserved. "Please procure, in your name, papers for travelling to France and England," he ordered a Geneva-based comrade called Vyacheslav Karpinsky on the 6th or 19th of March. "I will use them when passing through England and Holland to Russia. I can wear a wig." His most desperate plan was to acquire the passport of some deaf-mute Swede, though where or how remained unclear. The idea crumpled when his wife reminded him that he would give the game away on any crowded train because he shouted in his sleep. He would have woken an entire carriage, she was certain, with his outbursts, in vernacular but unmistakable Russian, about the perfidies of Kerensky and Milyukov. That left one option, but it was absurd. The Swiss exiles could travel across Germany to the Baltic coast and on from there to Sweden, Tornio and home. Radek floated the idea, perhaps because he knew that some of the Russians who worked for Parvus in Copenhagen had received transit visas from the authorities in Berlin. Years later, Radek also claimed that it was he who had persuaded a journalist, Dr. Deinhard, to sound out the German plenipotentiary in Bern. Whoever it was who first thought of it, however, Lenin's initial response to the idea was dismissive. To accept the assistance of an enemy in time of war would have been to expose himself to charges of treason. That would not do for any self-respecting revolutionary. His business, after all, was not mere perfidy, but global civil war. The strains of war were telling on the German government as well. That bastion of protocol, the foreign ministry, had acquired an unconventional new master, for Yagov had gone, and Arthur Zimmermann had been promoted to replace him. Zimmermann was a Prussian and a career diplomat. But he was also a wild card. A devotee of Mosel wine, a quart of which he was accustomed to consuming with his lunch, and a covert operations addict. Soon after his promotion, he took an initiative involving Mexico, for he was conscious of a growing risk that the United States might join the war on the opposing side. In a telegram of January 1917, he suggested that Germany might reward Mexico for any wartime support in the Western Atlantic by helping it to recover the lost states of Nevada, New Mexico, and Arizona. The British intercepted this Zimmermann telegram and could not quite believe their luck. There was a pause while they worked out exactly how to leak its contents, for their practice of decoding the classified diplomatic correspondence of friendly powers was not entirely to their credit. They waited until early March to break the scandal, exploiting it to push the US government towards the brink of war. Washington's formal declaration was issued on the 4th of April. With the Americans arming at last, the pressure on Berlin could only grow. But Germany's military strategists had been aware for some months that their time was short. The war was straining the home front to breaking point. The Royal Navy's maritime blockade had resulted in the fractious turnip winter of 1916-17, when civilians in some German towns came close to suffering the sort of hunger that would push the Russians to revolt. Protests in German cities stopped well short of revolution, but many witnessed violent unrest. The news from Russia, coming in the darkest month before the spring, could hardly have been more explosive for public morale. German's monarchy was bigoted and visibly preposterous. The messages from Petrograd would have been dangerous for any unreformed regime. But in this case, there was a well-established left-wing socialist party to amplify them straight away. One or two trump cards, however, still nestled in the German army's hand. The Royal Navy's very dominance had pushed the High Command to approve a campaign of unrestricted submarine warfare. The plan was to sink any ship that came in sight after the 1st of February 1917. The resulting mayhem was almost certain to bring the United States into the war, which prospect had prompted Zimmermann to approach the Mexicans in the first place. But there would be an interval while Congress considered its options, and then a month or two while the United States prepared an expeditionary force. That window, it was hoped, would be just wide enough for German troops to crush the French. As for the routing of Russia, the most recent campaigning season, with its victories in Romania, had been magnificent. If that went on, the German High Command could hope for a separate peace in Eastern Europe that might free its forces for a death blow in the West. Before the news of Russia's revolution broke, however, in November 1916, the chance of any deal with Nicholas II had been destroyed by yet another German imperial manifesto on the future state of Poland, large parts of which the Russian Empire thought it ruled. Since it would probably have taken a revolution to bring the Tsar to the negotiating table after that, the news of Petrograd's uprising was like a gift from Providence. According to one colourful account, German intelligence first learned what was happening when a listening post in the Finnish city of Helsingfors, now Helsinki, intercepted several messages from military units who wanted to know which civil authority they were supposed to be obeying. A flurry of encrypted messages followed on the German side, all proposing a different plan for taking advantage of Russia's plight. But the intervention of Baron Helmut Lucius von Staden, the man in Stockholm, was decisive. As he advised Berlin, Russia's new rulers were divided among themselves. If Germany could resist the temptation to attack, the advocates of peace in Petrograd would almost certainly prevail. Among Lucius's most useful informants in this matter had been a German socialist, Wilhelm Janssen, a man with great potential to be useful to Berlin. He knew some of the Russian comrades personally. It looked as if it might be time to send him off to talk to them. The first thing to get right, meanwhile, was propaganda. It took an effort for Germany's agents to abandon their long-standing strategy of painting Britain as the villain in a Russian peasants' war. For months, they'd been dropping information leaflets over lines of puzzled Russian troops in an attempt to convince them that the only real winners in the current conflict were London's bankers. When it was clear that Nicholas had gone, the Germans blamed the British for forcing Russia's heaven-sent Tsar to resign. New leaflets urged the anxious men to go home and rescue their people and Mother Russia. After a day or two, when it emerged that this approach was also doomed, the propagandists' focus shifted to the yearning for peace, which was genuine, a message they presented with a string of genuflections to the soldiers' cherished Orthodox faith. "Germany is ready to make peace," read one leaflet that Knox acquired, "though peace is not necessary for her. She will wait patiently to see if the new and free Russia will start peace negotiations with us in the holy holidays of Christ's resurrection." While Berlin waited to see what would come of that, the minister in Copenhagen, Brock Dovrantzau, who was also a friend of Zimmermann's, busied himself among the spies. It was not long before he found himself ushering Parvus through his office door. The big man still had good contacts in Petrograd. As a socialist, he had plans for Russia of his own, including armed uprisings and a massive redistribution of the land. But as a supporter of Germany, he was at Rantzau's disposal. As usual, he wanted money for himself. He asked for an advance of 5 million marks to finance revolutionary propaganda. His message, however, was that Rantzau should back the Bolsheviks. In a series of meetings in Copenhagen, he convinced the German envoy that finance for extremist elements would hasten Russia's disintegration and end the war on the Eastern Front in no more than 3 months. The only way for Lenin to get back to Russia, however, would be for him to go through Germany. Foreign Minister Zimmermann's appetite for a plot was still as keen as it had ever been. "Since it is in our interests that the influence of the radical wing of the Russian revolutionary should prevail," he wrote to Lerchner, the liaison officer at military headquarters, on the 10th or 23rd of March, "it would seem to be advisable to allow transit to the revolutionaries." The military men agreed. But it was entirely another matter to convince Lenin. Like almost everyone who needed help, Parvus began to talk to Fürstenberg, sounding him out about an approach to the Bolshevik leader. By now, as Parvus must have known, Fürstenberg was also in daily telegraphic contact with Lenin, who regarded him as his right-hand man in Scandinavia. The only person to whom he was writing more frequently at this point was Inessa Armand. Fürstenberg's credentials as a travel agent were formidable. As soon as the news of the revolution had reached Sweden, he had joined some other Stockholm Russians to form a committee for the repatriation of political exiles. When Lenin despaired of finding legal routes to Tornio, it was to Fürstenberg that he sent his photograph, concealed inside the binding of a book, in the hope that the businessman could get a false passport arranged. It was natural, then, that the first agent Parvus and his colleagues sent to Lenin, Georg Sklatz, who was also a business partner in the Handels og Exports Kompaniet, came as a representative of Fürstenberg. The trouble was that Lenin was no fool. When Sklatz made the mistake of offering to pay for Lenin's journey, the leader threw him out, rightly suspecting German subterfuge. As Gisbert von Romberg, the German envoy in Bern, wrote to Berlin on the 3rd of April, 21st of March, "Although I have made our willingness to cooperate known to the émigrés, nobody has yet contacted me, apparently because the émigrés are afraid of compromising themselves in Petrograd. I do not think that we can do anything but wait." 2 weeks had passed since the fall of the Tsar. The Russian exiles argued with each other and their local hosts, several of whom were offering to negotiate for German help on their behalf. The Menshevik faction under Martov was holding out for a formal invitation from the provisional government. The Bolsheviks refused to work with Martov's group. And Lenin had dreamed up a sort of lawyer's list of conditions before he would agree to anything. In France, Le Petit Parisien ran a short piece reporting Milyukov's announcement that any Russian exile who accepted German help to return home would be arrested at the border. But there were no alternative routes. At the end of March, Lenin met a representative of the German embassy in the company of witnesses such as the French journalist Henri Guilbeau. He also accepted the mediation of the Swiss socialist leader Robert Grimm. Between the 29th of March and the 2nd of April 1917, or 16th and 20th of March Russian style, Grimm held four meetings with Romberg. But the Swiss leader was no admirer of Lenin, and he was exasperated by the other Russians' endless wrangling. Grimm gave up trying on the 2nd of April. The next day, Lenin's Swiss acolyte, Fritz Platten, a loyal veteran of Zimmerwald, was deputed to take over the trilateral talks. An exhausted Romberg submitted Lenin's full list of terms to Berlin on the 5th of April. Most striking of these was that any carriage in which the Russians crossed Germany should have the status of an extraterritorial entity. Fritz Platten, as a neutral, would act as the contact between the passengers and their German guards, and no one would enter the exiles' carriage without permission. As far as possible, the carriage was to travel without stops, and it was minuted that no passenger could be ordered to leave. There would be no control of passports and no discrimination against potential passengers on the grounds of their political views. The German negotiators were bending over backwards to assist a group whose leaders they regarded as the vilest criminals. But the gamble was also evidence of German confidence. The beauty of the Bolsheviks was that they looked set to dismember Russia for all time. But their efforts might need months to bear real fruit. A safer bet, albeit one that promised a much lesser prize, would simply have been to start talking with Lvov, Guchkov, and Kerensky. As Rantzau had put it on the 2nd of April, "If we are not in a position to continue the war until the end of this year with any likelihood of success, then we should try to achieve a rapprochement with the moderate parties now in power." By backing Lenin, Zimmermann was putting some of his chips on the more risky option, confident that it was worth a try. The gamble might result in one of any ungovernable range of results, including very little at all. But there was still a hope that it would end by disabling the Russian colossus forever. News of Lenin's negotiations spread through Zurich's cafes within hours. James Joyce, who heard the story over a drink, thought the proposed safe passage was proof that the Germans must be pretty desperate. The French novelist Romain Rolland dismissed Lenin and his aspiring fellow passengers as nothing more than instruments of Europe's enemy. The 8th of April was Easter Sunday in Switzerland, and the authorities had hoped to have the Russians packed onto their trains before the holiday began. Instead, the weekend was the most frantic of all. To make the whole business more difficult, a chorus of abuse accompanied the travellers' every move. With plenty of time on their hands, the émigrés, who were still waiting for a formal invitation from Milyukov, joined forces with centre-left Swiss in calling Lenin a traitor. The greatest strain fell on Romberg and Platten. Both had to deal with endless small details. Both disliked the idea of even speaking to the other side, and both knew that exacting masters might destroy their work. For the Germans, it was important that the military should approve the precise route from the Swiss border. Russian-speaking German guards had also discreetly to be appointed to travel inside the carriage for security. At one stage, it was also suggested that the amenable Wilhelm Janssen, as a representative of the German trades unions, should join the Russians for the German leg of the journey. Romberg put a stop to that, interrupting his Easter Sunday devotions to explain to Berlin that the émigrés expect to encounter extreme difficulties, even legal persecution, from Russian government because of travel through enemy territory. It is therefore essential to their interests that they be able to guarantee not to have spoken with any German in Germany. Platen will explain this to Janssen. While the wires from Bern to Berlin ran hot, Lenin commuted almost daily between Zurich and the Swiss capital. Many of his potential followers were too poor to pay for a transcontinental journey, but he refused to let the Germans simply bankroll them. The long-suffering Robert Grimm agreed to organize a committee to raise some cash from local socialists. At the last moment, Platen was detailed to secure permission for the group to bring its own food. There were appeals from unsuitable hangers-on who wanted to join the party, and problems with the final list of conditions to put to the Germans. In spare moments, Lenin continued to devour every scrap of Russian news, and he was also writing, drafting, marshalling his thoughts. On the morning before his departure, in one last desperate attempt to secure the Allies' blessing, he telephoned the US Embassy in Bern. The young man who picked up the phone recognized the caller's name. But it was Easter Sunday, and he was on his way to a tennis match. "Call back on Monday," he advised, and thought no more of it. When that official, whose name was Alan Dulles, became one of the most influential heads of the CIA, it was a story he would go on telling to recruits for years. On Easter Monday, the 9th of April, the travellers finally gathered in the Zahringerhof, the hotel on the square outside Zurich's faux classic railway station. 32 adults were to travel, including Nadezhda Krupskaya and Inessa Armand. There must have been a lot of surreptitious studying of fellow travellers' packed baskets, stolen glances to size up the bread rolls and the chocolate bars. Zinoviev had turned up with his wife and 9-year-old son. But at the last moment, and no doubt to his exasperation, his flamboyant first wife, Olga Ravitch, otherwise known as Sara Savitch, had also joined the party. Two Georgians were on the list, a young writer called David Suliashvili, and the veteran activist, Mika Tskarakaya, whose moustache and outlandish sheepskin cap, retained through years of exile in Paris, made him look like a music hall bandit. It turned out that Skarakaya had brought no baggage for the journey at all. But no one could object to him. Lenin regarded another passenger, Grigory Uzievich, who was travelling with his wife Elena, as a spineless dolt, while Elena's father, Felix Kohn, who was also in the party, was an old fool, whom Lenin could not stand. It may have been as well that there were also several lawyers in the group, two children, and at least one dentist. The last thing to be done was to eat lunch, a noisy banquet in the Zahringerhof that was accompanied by speeches of farewell. It was Lenin's final chance to win over the many critics who were still attempting to prevent the trip. Instead, he opted for frontal attack, dismissing Grimm in the same breath as he condemned the right-wing social patriots. He predicted a worldwide revolution that would sweep away the filthy froth on the surface of the world labour movement. "The objective circumstances of the imperialist war," he declared, "make it certain that the revolution will not be limited to the first stage of the Russian Revolution, that the revolution will not be limited to Russia. Transformation of the imperialist war into civil war is becoming a fact." He was not going home to strike some deal with Russia's bourgeoisie or haggle over tactics in the back of an official car. He was already planning to take the revolution forward to its second stage and set fire to the European left. At the end of the meeting, the Bolshevik leader read aloud a statement in French and German on behalf of his whole group. They were returning to their homeland, it announced, despite Milyukov's threat of jail. Every passenger had signed the formal conditions, which included an acceptance of the risks. Shouts and hisses followed them across the square as the travellers made for their first train. It was merely a local Swiss service bound for Schaffhausen and the border post of Gottmaringen. But the Russians approached it as if walking the plank. Lenin may have preferred Fritz Platten's simile. He suggested that they should imagine themselves to be like gladiators, squaring up before their greatest and final contest. The pugilist image was exactly right, for as the engine finally began to move, Lenin noticed a stranger on the train, whose presence was, in fact, legitimate, since this was not a special service, let alone a sealed carriage. A German socialist called Oskar Blum had decided to take his chance. Assuming him to be a spy, the Bolshevik leader seized the intruder by the collar and physically threw him out onto the track.